Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is author, broadcaster, fashion and beauty maven, and entrepreneur, Trini Woodall. Sarah Jane Duncanson Woodall's interest in personal appearance began at an early age. She reputedly earned the nickname Trini from a family friend and director of the St. Trinian's films after being sent home from school aged five for cutting off another girl's plait. Trini's urge to make over would find its natural home in 2001 in What Not to Wear, the phenomenally successful BBC show she fronted with Susanna Constantine. Trini and Susanna presented five series of the show before defecting to ITV to present Trini and Susanna Undress. In 2017, Trini founded the wildly successful beauty brand Trini London, offering simple, chic and effective makeup and skincare products to busy modern women wanting to look great fast. But being so well known for quite frank assessments of how others present themselves, does Trini think her own appearance has consequently come under unfair scrutiny? Or is she as hard on herself? But before that, a massive thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Skin & Me. Skin & Me is your most accessible, fast track to simplified skincare, offering powerful active ingredients in formulations you can't buy on the high street. Skin & Me can create a treatment for your specific skin concerns, tailored to you by experts. Whether you want to target adult acne, pigmentation, melasma, rosacea, or skin aging, this is powerful, personalized skincare that truly works. As someone who has used Skin & Me for years, I can honestly say I wouldn't go without it. Later in this series, I'm delighted to say we'll be joined by one of Skin & Me's very own dermatologists to answer any and all of your pressing skincare questions. You can submit your question by emailing btb@insanityhq.com. That's btb@insanityhq.com. Now on to today's episode of Beyond the Bathroom. Welcome, Trini Woodall. Hello.
Hello, Sally.
We're in a lovely, dark, womb-like studio.
So nice, with the most flattering lighting.
We look very pretty because the light was right in Trini's eyes. She could barely see, so we've turned the lights off and I quite like it. How are you?
I'm good. I've had a long week and I'm quite, you know, when you wake up, you know how tired you are.
Yeah.
So I had that day today where I wanted to escape to lie on my bed for 2 minutes, you know, that kind of day.
We should have done this in your bed.
And we could have done this in my bed. But it didn't stop me from doing my Pilates in the morning and stuff, because there's a certain, I know I have to do this, whatever.
Oh, I want to come back to that because I'm useless. And so the fact that you're physically able with exercise, I think is very interesting. I want to start, though, where I always start, because I do think it's so influential. Tell me about the women in your young life.
My mother, who hardly ever wore makeup. In fact, I bought her, you know, Evian cleanser in 1992. Mm-hmm. And wore sort of number 7 orange lip. Salmon, actually. And she had very yellow teeth, my mother, because she was a sort of baby in the war that, you know, didn't have her teeth looked after. Very, very unvain. No vanity about her whatsoever. My father, you should ask about, was the peacock in the family.
Great. Tell me about him.
So he always was well-groomed, handsome man, and a sort of bon vivant. You know, he would be the centre of the sort of dinner party conversation. And I'm the youngest of 6 of his children. So now I have an older sister who was 4 years older, who I always felt was utterly glamorous and always had a life that I felt was, you know, I found my life boring in comparison to my sister's for the first 20 years of our life, probably. And then I have 2 older sisters who I don't see that much. They're half sisters. So they didn't really have an influence on my life. But I had a godmother who was from Scotland, redhead, beautiful redhead. And she went to America and married somebody. And I went to New York when I was about 15, still with quite really bad skin. And she introduced me to, you know, walking down Fifth Avenue, Lord and Taylor, at the end, the Clinique counter in 1979.
So the Clinique counter, I think, for lots of us, including me, was the big one, was the first one where we became... I mean, they invented modern skincare. Let's give credit where it's due.
Exactly.
And it's where and the routine, it all began. Yeah,
the routine,
right.
And also that introduction in the routine that wasn't the sort of Helena Rubinstein Estée Lauder one. It was this... There are three steps and there's this thing in the middle and it's an astringent and, you know, it could be like paint stripper if it was number four. But it was just, it was that. And also it was the way that it moved and you kind of could work yourself out. That probably was my inspiration.
It was a diagnostic computer, they called it. But it was really just a slidey Perspex thing.
But compared to anything else, it was magnificent. So definitely that. And I spent all my pocket money that I had for New York on skincare.
So you mentioned, and I know you're using the term loosely, that you had bad skin. At which point in your life had you first become aware of your own appearance?
Probably when I got bad skin.
So what did that look like?
That was 13 at school and just getting spots, but my spots just got a bit worse than other people's. And just going on limitless amounts of tetracycline, minocin, you know, always on an antibiotic from about 16 to about 20. And before that was just my mother taking me to St. Michael's, you know, and getting me pond cream and that kind of, I mean, it was just the most basic things. My mother had no, she'd never had a spot in her life and didn't know what it was and was flummoxed that she had a child who had acne. So I just then went on my own. I think that's why very early on I was my own researcher of things from probably about 13.
And how were things at school? Did you board?
I bored from 6.5 and then until about 9.5. And then I took 2 years in Germany where they lived. And then I went back to boarding school about 11. So I remember I had Noxzema from America. Mm-hmm. That was the thing I used to wash my face with. And there was a sort of medicinal. Do you remember the smell? I love the smell of Noxzema.
I
it's
do
this
too.
American thing. And it just, and I felt there was something medicinal about it. And then I had Betadine. That sort of brown, horrible liquid, which I clean my face with, very abrasive, very drying. So it was that boarding school life. And boarding school is, you know, where you, everyone shares everything. So you, in a way, pick lots of things up quicker to do with those nighttime routines because you're all doing it together. You're not just with your mother in a house who has no interest in beauty. So I had very quickly other resources in which I could compare and contrast.
And the absence of boys. I think lots of us are quite interested in boarding school for this kind of total absence of boys. And does that affect your self-image positively or negatively or both?
I can only say it in regards to my daughter, looking at her going to an all-girls boarding school, but a lot of her friends at co-eds in London and seeing the difference.
Right.
And my daughter has bad skin. And whenever I comment on it, because it's a history of my relationship with my skin, she said, "Mum, you're more concerned about my bad skin than I am." And that's so interesting because she hasn't been in a situation which has made her feel self-conscious and there's outside forces. And then I feel really bad because I feel I don't want to give her some, you know, like, I don't care, so why should you? And I said, "I'm sorry, darling, it's just because I had bad skin. I just want you to get in the habit of washing your face every night and taking off your makeup, you know, and changing your pillow and putting your hair back."
It's the battle of all mothers of teenagers. Before we continue with this conversation, here's a quick message from our wonderful series sponsor, Skin and Me. As we discuss in this episode, acne can be disruptive to our lives, no matter what age we are. Skin and Me are the acne experts who offer gold standard ingredients for treating acne and adult acne for you or your child. If they're age 16 or above, they can get advice and personalised treatments from Skin and Me's dermatology clinicians without the usual wait for a dermatologist's appointment. Or the cost. Any tweaks needed to the formula are free, and you should see visible results in around 90 days. Skin and Me believe in simple skincare solutions that actually work. Every single consultation and photo that you submit is personally reviewed by an expert dermatology clinician, never an algorithm or AI. Skin and Me offers gold standard ingredients in personalized formulations for treating acne, rosacea, pigmentation, and the early signs of skin aging, with decades of evidence backing them up.
Their formulations are also highly effective when it comes to cosmetic skin concerns like dullness, uneven texture, and enlarged pores. Try your first month of personalized treatment from Skin & Me for just $4.99. $24.99 thereafter. Just visit skinandme.com and use the code SALLYANDME to get started. That's SALIANDME to get started. Let's start with fashion before we move into beauty, but of course they are one and the same thing in so many ways. At which point did you get a sense that appearances would be a job for you?
I think very young at boarding school that first time. I stayed at the school a bit because my parents lived away, and so I didn't necessarily see them between the beginning of term and end of term. Mm-hmm. So I stayed at school. Mm-hmm. And there were a few other people who stayed at school. A lot of kids who lived in Nigeria and Ghana, and one or two in from just mainly kids who were abroad. So we just compare stuff. And we'd, you know, I always, because I lived abroad, I maybe had different clothes that I brought. Benetton had started in Europe. It wasn't in England yet. And I brought, you know.
The height of glamour, Benetton.
Matching skirts and tops and those twin sets. And I think I got my obsession with order in a wardrobe from Benetton and that first shop in London in Knightsbridge in 1978, nine. And it was just this, it was the most incredible thing. And so I did do lots of makeovers on people at school.
I was going to ask
that. I used to pierce girls' ears too. Things
did
like
you?
That. Yes, I did. I did it with...
Were you sanitary?
I used that fluid you use, icing thing and, you know...
That you put on
de-icer a car. De-icer and a car. You know, that stuff.
I think,
I don't know what it's called, but it was very good.
I mean, it must be full of alcohol. It would have done something.
Yeah, full of alcohol, exactly. And a safety pin, which I burnt.
I was going to ask about that because I think for lots of us who work in this industry, we were that girl who would do someone's makeup before the school disco or would help someone choose a dress in Miss Selfridge or whatever. So you were that girl.
I was that girl.
And were you popular?
I was very shy when I was younger and felt that I found it really difficult to make friends. And I also had changed schools a bit. So I went to a boarding school early. It was a really cruel boarding school. So I just have incredibly unhappy memories from that school. And then my parents took me to a day school in Germany, but it was an American day school, didn't bond there. They'd all been there for years with each other. And then I joined for 2 years. And then I went to my school at 10 and a half. So I was a bit young for my age. So I then finally really tried to make friends, made friends by the summer term, and then they kept me down a year because I wasn't academically good enough. So I had to start all over. And, you know, at that time, and still today, you don't speak to the girl in the year below.
Right.
So I remember just feeling I was trying to, you know, work my way through treacle in terms of just getting connections with people and not knowing how to do it. And then my sister was also at school and she was very popular. And at all girls' schools, you have these things where you crush on a girl and you give her sweets and writing paper. And they all crushed on my sister. And so...
How much older is she?
4 years.
Okay.
And she was cool. She ran the, you know, the student council. She did a food strike. Everyone followed her. She was a cool girl. So it was very difficult because all the teachers thought I would be as naughty as her and all the girls thought I'd be as fun as her. So I always felt I didn't live up to the image. And then when she left, I think I found it easy. I found who I was. Very similar with Susanna and I that stopped working together. I found a bit more of who I was. Mm-hmm.
It's a codependent thing, isn't it? That you have with the girls you really love.
Yeah. Maybe.
That you kind of surrender a little bit of yourself to them and they to you.
Yeah.
So I remember when you and she came onto the scene. And I think part of your appeal was that you weren't fashion women. Mm-hmm. You were not industry women who wore all black and sat on the front row. There was
the
sense...
The opposite.
Right.
I mean, we would be... Because Hilary Alexander was running the fashion on the Telegraph, an amazingly inspiring fashion editor.
She was amazing. And she gave me a big break in the Alexander.
Yeah, and so dedicated to her craft. But she was very challenged by us appearing at the Telegraph.
Was she?
Tricky.
Because you weren't proper fashion.
Because we weren't proper fashion and we were given a whole page on Saturday in the weekend section. And we were we made her life sometimes difficult because we said, this is great and this is shit. And we would write letters to Karl Lagerfeld saying, how can you charge $2,000 yeah. for a plastic brooch? You know, what is this? So we challenged elements of fashion. And I think then, and you were younger than me, Sally, but you'll vaguely remember, there was very high-end clothes or anything that was sort of high street, like Warehouse yeah. or Cook Eye. They would make something to be in vogue, but it would never be in store. So,
yes.
so the challenge for us was, how can we... make something of a page where you look at it on Saturday and you can go in a store that afternoon and you know it would be there. And at that time, before the life of social media, you didn't have the opportunity to have things that you knew where they were. You know, you wouldn't be able to know that that thing was in, not Mango, it wasn't around then, Warehouse or Cook Eye. And sometimes we would, you know, have people send us things and we would say, put them up and say, this is why it's bad. You know, so then Hillary was maybe getting her team to get some stuff. And then they were like, yeah, but the Telegraph just dissed our clothes. So that was a bit of a challenge. And then at fashion shows, we were never sat with the press. We were sat with the customer because they had to kind of, you know, we were not the press. It was just, it was interesting. And I just, it was funny.
That stuck with you, I think. That's been a common thread throughout your career, whether in fashion or beauty, that you're a punter.
I'm a punter.
Yeah.
Yeah, a punter. That's a very good way of putting it.
That you're the kind of voice of the punter. You're the,
yeah.
you're the customer.
Yeah.
And so this blew up. So it was a page in the Telegraph. Mm-hmm. You were just jobbing journalists who had this page that really resonated mm-hmm. with women. Because as you say, they could just go and buy this stuff. And it wasn't for fashion girls and it wasn't by fashion girls. And then it just exploded. It was a phenomenon, wasn't it? Tell me about that.
It was... It's very interesting to look back and think something explodes. But it was, in a way, to me at the time, it was a slow burn because we were doing that. Then I actually started an online business, which was Ready Too. This is in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And 1998, 99. And raised money and got to a company of 60 people. And I just was so excited by what online could do. I was so excited by databases, personalization, all this stuff. And it was the very beginning of e-com in you know, that was happening around the world. It was a very interesting time to be in the online world because it was really embryonic. And if I look at the people who survived that dot-com bubble, you have people like Michael, who now has Calm. We were all together at these conferences talking about online, you know. So it then closed and Susanna went off to have a baby. And I was like, what are we going to do? And we'd done a tiny pilot and then we got that commission. So then from started doing that, had done one book before, which... you know, sold 13,000 copies, which at the time wasn't very much, called Ready to Dress, with kind of melons and fried eggs on our fronts. And we had a tube campaign the same for the internet site and stuff. And then we did the first show on BBC Two and it just picked up. You know, it was a new kind of show. The Close Show had been on for years and then it had stopped. So there had been a gap in the idea of a makeover show. And the premise of the show was never to say, hey, you're horrid, we'll make you nice, you know. And there's a lot of fun TikTok trends of the horror of our show, which I find interesting because it's the emotional relationship we had with the contributors. And it was all about, you don't value yourself. How can we help you to value yourself more so you dress differently, so you do your hair differently, whatever. And then it went to BBC One because we got quite a big audience for Two. And then we did a book and we sold a million copies. And then it's sort of every year we did another show and another book. So it was very, really successful. But then every August, I was like, will we get recommissioned? You know that feeling, having a contract with a journalist. Will you get recommissioned? Will you get the show? You know, will it come back again? And that kind of lurching of, can I pay the mortgage? Can I pay the rent? And it happened every year.
It's brilliant that you mentioned that TikTok thing. So there is a trend on TikTok of taking shows, films, interviews, out of historical context and saying, oh my God, isn't this bloody awful?
Mm.
And of course, everything is. But, you know, we forget the fact that everything was propped up by all of society at the time, that everybody yeah. else was talking that way. I wonder if there is, looking back on what not to wear, would you do things differently now? Has your view around body image changed at all?
Totally. I do a show now, which we do on YouTube, The Takeover Show. We might have 300,000 views on it or something, but in a day, we do a makeover. We shoot it with two iPhones. It costs us probably £1,500 a show, maybe 2,000 if we're really pushing on the edit. And when I look at how I am now with somebody, I feel I'm not that different, but I'm more myself because, you know, when you're doing a show with a big production team, there's like, stop now, could you say that again? And with my team, I'm like, we're just going to roll. I'm never going to repeat anything. We're just going to do it as is. And we're going to catch those moments and edit them down. So we make the show differently. And somebody applies and I literally just dress them and I get them to look at themselves and see, you know, a lot of people look in a mirror and don't see themselves. And the biggest thing in that show, which was still the same as before, is to take a photograph of somebody and make them look at the photograph themselves because they have a slightly more objective view of their body. And most of the issues around dressing are around people's body dysmorphia. And every woman will have a small bit, or in the case of anorexia and food disorders, a very big body dysmorphia. And we've had on the shows we did, not so much in England, but we went abroad afterwards when we were no longer doing it here, and Kok Wan came out and Nikki came out and did those shows. And those were very emotional stories, really emotional. But, you know, a lot of people who hadn't learned to love themselves and their body. So I learned a lot, I think, in how to. So, you know, when I look at now how I behave, how I am me. But I think doing 4 years out of England in 12 countries with very different types of women. So in India, doing Hindi women, in Israel, doing Orthodox Jewish women, in Australia and Scandinavia and Netherlands, where it's the tall poppy syndrome, not wanting to stand out, right, doing women like that. I just learned so much more, I think, than just doing it in England.
I suppose what intrigues me, I watched some old clips of that show and got, you know, I watched it religiously at the time, everybody did. But when I was rewatching them, I suppose where my mind went was, I wondered where you were with your own, where you were in your own journey of self-image, body image at the time you were making those shows. You were kind of helping other women and developing these bonds with other women, and there you are with your best friend. But where are you with your own stuff?
So from 35 to 39, which is predominantly when I made the BBC show, I was doing 9 rounds of IVF. And IVF,
right,
has
a
big impact on, you know, doing gonol F every day and also miscarrying. So that relationship was a very hormonal one. It wasn't, you know, it was beyond that sense of, oh, are my genes not fitting today? Because there's so much more important things going on. So the ability to be objective around one's body,
right,
for the sake of, my body's not in a stage where I'm holding a baby.
Yeah.
My body's not in a stage where I'm getting pregnant. And so you look at your body differently, and there's different things you attach to that. So I had a very thin womb lining. I could never hold on to the embryo, you know. So then it was injections every day of this horrible steroid to get them. So just my body was this vehicle that I wanted to work so I could hold a baby.
And I know from talking to various girlfriends, lots of them felt as though their body was failing them, their body was letting them down, because you're in such this heightened state, whether that's true or not, of course it's not, but in a heightened emotional state, you can think negatively about your body and its capabilities.
I think for me, it was more, you think, if I hadn't done that, maybe I wouldn't have lost,
right,
the baby, or if I hadn't done that, maybe the pregnancy would have worked. You question that. And then I had a very nice woman who was my fertility woman at the Lister and called Murray Wren. Phenomenal woman. And she said, Trini, you know, the embryo is a feather inside a hot air balloon, you know, inside a big balloon. So never feel that, you know, because you did that or you were very active, you know. And she's right from a physical perspective, but from a stress and what stress does,
right,
to our body, which I think is a little less known. We don't always know if that impact of stress actually, you know, plays with everything.
Yeah, I remember Dr. Robert Winston, I interviewed him years ago, and he said to me, frankly, it's a miracle that anybody gets pregnant, carries a baby and delivers it. The whole thing is so fraught.
Yeah.
It's the most fraught, dangerous, risky, yeah, unpredictable, unreliable process in the world. It's miraculous that people continue to do,
yeah,
it. So this was a huge, huge global movement, the What Not to Wear. And so when it went away at this point, so you mentioned your age there, in those days, 39, quite old in the media,
mm-hmm,
these days not so much.
Mm-hmm.
How did that leave you feeling about your life stage? Did you think, well, that's it?
No, I think I was a bit older though as well, because I think I had Lila then. So I was saying that section of my work, but I did telly for 10 years in that tranche. So probably till about 44.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe till 43, I was working in England. And then it did dry up. And then at the same time, other things were happening. So we were sort of wanting, I think we both felt we'd really worked a lot. And then you sort of think, do I want to work this hard? And then suddenly the job doesn't appear. And then you're like, okay, getting what I wanted, but in fact, now can I pay the mortgage?
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. And then we were offered a show abroad in Belgium. And then I thought, God, you know, it's a tenth of the price of the UK, but I have no way of earning a job. I could go and work in a coffee shop, yes, but when you spent years in one career, you kind of want to stay in that field.
Sure.
And I just thought, let's take it. So we said, let's take it. And then we went from what we thought was working hard to doing a Monday to a Friday abroad and coming back. And we did that about 7 months of the year, 8 months of the year.
It's a lot.
It was so much. It was really challenging. And after about 4 years of that, we realized we just couldn't do that. And then we both knew, by then I knew I was going to do Trini London. Susanna knew she wanted to write.
Okay, so you knew you were going to do Trini London. So at which point did this come to you? Why did it come to you?
I first thought about it in about 2010. But my agent said to me the other day, Trini, I remember being with you in Israel when you were filming in 2007. You brought out that bloody stack and you said, Michael, I'm going to make this a business. So don't think it was then. I think I just harped on about it so much. But we can have this thing where we have an idea and we're too scared to start it. So we tell lots of people about what it's
right.
going to be.
And then we'll have to do it, or it's effectively done.
And it's like we never had to face the challenges of doing it, but we never saw it thoroughly succeed, but we never saw it fail. It's like limbo land. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating. Or mm-hmm. It's like somebody who knows about recovery and still decides to use. There's a little bit of
right.
that. All right. So probably it was about when I was still filming abroad and I would compartmentalize my makeup into these tiny things, and I always mixed together a lot of different colors, and I would always put different, like always in my foundation, I would put in a bit of Jammarine as vitamin C, and then I'd put in a little bit of hyaluronic acid, and I just want to get this, you know, I'm obsessed that the texture of coverage on the face should look like skin, always.
So you were a scooper and a scraper?
A scooper and a scraper.
Okay.
I love that. And I would be abroad and I'd literally stick this thing together and I'd be in bathrooms. People go, what's that? And I'll go, it's my makeup bag. And they go, you know, and I just kept thinking, I will one day. And then I was doing the show and then it was just so much work, so much traveling. We both had our kids. Susanna and I thought, we can't do this. We cannot be away. And I thought, this is the time. I have to do it now.
And so tell me about that journey. That is a big ass project.
Mm-hmm.
To launch, and you launched fairly fully formed. You had a lot of product on launch. You had more than usual, I would say.
Yeah.
I was sent the whole range and there was a lot. You know, you had cheek colour, you had eye colour, you had a base, I think, mm-hmm. very early on, if not mm-hmm. straight away. And so what was the timeline on that? How long did that take you from actually going, I'm going to stop telling people and I'm going to start doing it?
Probably it was 2012 and I launched in 2017. So the first thing was beginning to look at how would I do it, you know. So just looking at a business plan, how would I do it? How would I sell it? Would I sell online or in store? I did actually start with thinking I'd sell it in store. And then I thought, actually, no, what I want to do is be able to get people who never bought online to buy online, because actually it's easier than buying in store. I was really into that challenge. And then I found a manufacturer in Italy and I kept sending them things. And I got 150,000 in an SEIS scheme, which is a scheme where you get taxpayers to invest. And for those people listening, it's a really good scheme. There aren't many great schemes for entrepreneurs, but it allows people that if their business to go under, they lose, I think, a third of their money and they get tax rebates. So I use that to send away my things I'd mix up, and so they'd start working, send them back. And that was a really slow process because yes. I wasn't kind of a company doing it, and I was a peon in their, you know, in their kind of the clients they had. And also a lot of those companies do just, they make something and people just buy them and label them. But I was saying, could you actually make this from scratch?
Yeah.
Not even think, could you make this from scratch? So that's, you know, you might find a base in some things. If it's a cream blusher, they might send you some bases and then you say, I like this, but we need to put more, you know, shea butter in it or whatever it is to make it the texture. So that took probably 2 years of just back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And then packaging and wanting, you know, a big thing was to have it stackable. And I had this idea of stackable. And then we did CADs on it, sent them off to China to get prototypes. That was a year. You know, I had 13 prototypes coming back and, you know, waiting 4 weeks for it to come back because I couldn't afford very expensive FedEx, you know, just all this kind of mechanics. And then, you know, I cried when I got them back because they were so shit. And then having to, you know, do the tweaking and the interpretation of how you want to tweak, so right, you know, speaking the language that somebody
barriers,
understood. Not even language barriers, but just when you know, tolerance, what is tolerance to you? What's tolerance to me? When you're making skincare packaging, there's always tolerance on design and this kind of 5 millimeter or 2 millimeter in which, so you can have somebody who does a beautiful design, but they haven't considered tolerance. You know, you have all things like that. So you learn a lot of steep learning curves. So probably it wasn't until about 2014, maybe 2015, by which I had, you know, and then I got stuff back. And then I had like 40 women in my bathroom. Every day I'd have different women. And I put this huge thing on the wall and I'd try every single shade on them. And I'd say, why are those good and why are those not good? And look at the skin, hair and eye combination. And the algorithm we then built was from this huge thing I had on my wall.
Wow.
I love putting things on my wall of a photograph, every single one of these sort of 45 women, and then all the colours they suited and didn't suit and why. And then that became the match to me. And then getting a techie to look at it, because I didn't have so much funding then. And then I knew I needed more funding. I knew to build it. I couldn't, because I wasn't just saying I'm going to start with 20 things and I'll start in a shop, which I think can be more self-financed. I think when you're older, you want to accelerate things. That's the one thing about age. It's the only thing about this instance. I wanted to really have that full proposition. And also because it's stacked, I want you to have everything you need there, not to, you know, add things on. So then I went and I sold my clothes and then I raised money. And then it was, you know, 2 years after that I launched.
Who did you think throughout this process, and you've got all these girls coming into your house, sitting in your bathroom, you're playing with their faces and everything. Did you have an idea who your woman was?
Totally.
So who was she? Is she?
She is not defined by age, even though many women sort of 40 to 60 are our definite market. But she is a grown-up woman. And when I say the words a grown-up woman, it's a woman who wants to stop playing and she wants the solution, you know. So she's not a grazer. She's on a mission to say, okay, this works for me, tick, I don't have to think about that anymore. And that was my woman.
Yeah, I think you've served her. You were very smart in the run-up, I thought, to the brand launching, in that you'd been a little bit off the scene for a few years because you'd clearly been so obsessed with this project and focused on that. So before we knew anything about the brand, you went in hard on social media. Did you know, I mean, it sounds like you're very tech savvy anyway, but did you know that that would be crucial to the success of the brand?
Being tech savvy is different from strategically thinking that that's crucial. And the reason I knew it would be important to build up that profile on social is when I went to investors and they were like, oh, you have 68,000 followers.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, no. And I was like, God, I've been so dismissed on that basis. And there I was, Trini, who'd been in 40 million homes around the world with What Not to Wear. So different and so irrelevant to this conversation to them. Mm-hmm. So irrelevant, you know. Half of them were 28 and weren't born by the time. But it was just understanding I have to somehow get in touch with those people who knew and empathise with my point of view. And I want to create new people who might be drawn to it too. So I remember I went to Facebook one day and they said, just go home, put your phone up and do a live. And I never did photographs. You know, when I started social, and I started in 2013, I think, I always did videos. And because I'm never good at still, I like to chat. So it was, you know, I got up and you know, the first comment was, are you Trini who used to be Trini and Susanna? You know, and I went, yes, hi, I am. And we just started these conversations. And it's a very intimate community. I mean, the community that's a part of, you know, on my different, on the different platforms is an amazing community. And very mutually nurturing.
I think that's right. Because the other thing about what you did, I think in a tech space, in a social media space, you actively reached out and embraced women who are kind of overlooked by beauty marketing, broadly speaking. Mm. And certainly were then. Less so now.
Yeah.
Everyone's on the menopause train, aren't they?
Yeah, but, they so are.
But at the time, there were lots of women who were ignored by brands, ignored by social media platforms, and so on. And I wonder what your time of life had done to educate that sense of inclusivity? Mm. I mean, you were the same age as these women, roughly.
Yes. And I don't know. I think I didn't think about it that proactively. It was a sort of more of an organic, just, you know, we're chatting, let's see what comes out of that. I think when you talk to people on Lives, they're very candid and they say, and it's incredible research. And on Facebook, unlike Instagram, do you remember Instagram when the comments would stay?
Yeah.
And but Facebook, they do. So you have a conversation and then you ask people what they think about stuff and you get a ton of phenomenal knowledge around what is the zeitgeist of how this collection of women are thinking about stuff. And it's incredibly helpful to then think, okay, well then I'm thinking of doing this, but I'm really noticing this here. And how can I include that in what I'm going to offer? How can I address that for them? So all those conversations, there was that sense of the confusion over the beauty counter. So when I was looking at Match to Me, and originally I was actually going to do your exact set, and not just, here's a refined choice.
And be quite prescriptive.
And be quite prescriptive.
Yeah.
And then I decided maybe that's too prescriptive. And so I did, you know, I did a more refined choice. But over the last years, because I look at all the data every day and stuff, and I realized so many, I sort of did a live on day and I said, why don't you buy online for the women who didn't? So I asked the question and I had 22,000 responses, which is just the best market research. So
I mean,
we had by that stage a million customers who were shopping online. But I knew that, you know, there's sort of 4 million across the different social channels. So, okay, some people. So why is it you don't buy? So one would be, I can't afford it, which I have an audience who also could afford some of the things and not the others. That's, I understand that. And then I still don't know what to choose when I go on the website. So then I spent the last year refining it and improving on this Match Me. So now I've just launched last week. This is your stack. You don't even think about it. You just have to trust me that we've looked at, you know, 3,200 women and these are colours that will suit you. So, you know, it's amazing how you have initially good ideas and then you say, oh no, a bit scared to do that. And then 5 years later, I'm going back to that thing I thought at launch, but I kind of wasn't brave enough to do.
In the run up to this conversation, I was asking lots of girlfriends about you. I was saying, what do you think about Trini? And something that comes up a lot in relation to you, which I think comes through in the brand, the overall sense was, well, she's a girl's girl. She likes women. She wouldn't shag your husband. That's kind of the vibe that people get from you. Do you think, I mean, I'm being crude about it, but do you think that's a fair assessment? Do you think that has helped with your brand, that there's a sense of warmth towards women?
I'd never flirt with another woman's husband.
No, I don't think
I just wouldn't.
I think it comes across.
I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I've never been unfaithful with somebody when I've been with somebody. It's just a thing. I do. I really love women, you know. And I sometimes have felt, you know, my most successful relationships have been with women more than men. So I feel much more comfortable with women. With men, I don't know quite maybe sometimes how to be me. With a woman, I so know how to be me. Yeah.
Watching back at all the sort of What Not to Wear clips, regardless of the sort of cadence at the time in the media and television, and yes, it could be brutal and so on, the number of times you tell, you and Susanna tell women that they've got great tits or a great ass or a beautiful face, I mean, it's countless. You say it all of the time. Mm. Are you a compliment giver and are you able to receive a compliment about your appearance?
I'm a compliment giver. And one thing it's interesting because in that show, people then expect you to be really honest. But when you're really honest, like, so last night I went to Toppings in Bath and I did a
I love that book bookshop.
So lovely.
And gorgeous.
I did a talk in St. Swithin's Church, a very beautiful church in Bath. And there were all these women. They all, you know, then I did signings and I spoke to all of them. So they say, what do you think? It's Cassie. So I still can't help myself if I see. So I was like, you've had that fringe for 30 years, haven't you? Okay, but I know when you wake up, you look in the mirror and it's your dark circles you don't like, isn't it? And they go, yep. And I go, you've got to get rid of the fringe because it's making your dark circle worse now. So I still, you know, they've maybe made a huge effort to get dressed to come and see me. And I, when I was going back last night, I was thinking, you know, I wouldn't want to think I'd upset anyone. So whenever I'm telling something to somebody which might be quite hard to hear, I'll balance it with something. You want somebody to be able to hear something really comfortably when you want to tell them something because you feel strongly that it might help them,
right?
But maybe they can't see it yet. I do that a little bit when I see a woman and I just think in these situations, she's probably made a huge effort to decide what to wear to come to this event and everything. So I would never say, oh, you're in totally the wrong color, you know, ever, because it would be hurtful. So you just got to, you know, think, what can you say that somebody's ready to hear? And I do have an intuition. The one thing I really know I have is, you know, I'll be in a room of 20 people and I'll be drawn to the woman who is most in pain and needs help. I'll just know who it is. You will do this too when we're very much physically around women and touching women. And
I'm hypervigilant, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
And I can read, I can take the temperature in a room quite quickly.
Yeah.
And it's that, isn't it? If there's one person who feels uncomfortable and sad, I will sense it straight away and try and fix it, which is probably not all that helpful, but good in our industry.
Good in our industry, yeah.
And how are you if a woman who loves you and comes at you with nothing but affection says, oh, Trini, I wish you wouldn't wear that skirt. It does nothing for you, or your hair needs to change or something. Are you able to take commentary on your own appearance, or is it uncomfortable?
Nobody says it.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's because they just are so aware of what they might think I'm thinking about, how they are. And then equally, sometimes people won't say, God, that's amazing, when, because they'll think she doesn't. So it's when you said that, I was thinking, how do I answer this? Because I haven't, you know, I would, like Susanna would say, what the fuck are you doing in that? You know, that kind of thing. And it's more of a way that we amuse each other rather than a statement of fact. So I will be much the harsher critic of myself than somebody else saying, you know, some people on social definitely say, Trini, I just, you know, really, sequins, so many sequins, really, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Or you're shopping in Zara again. Or, you know, I'll have that more than, do you think those trousers suit you? And then I will, when I'm doing a closet confessions or something, somebody will say, you know, because they'll feel a responsibility to tell me, you know, because I might say, shall I get this? So whenever I ask a question, which is inviting a, should I or shouldn't I? I'll get really honest feedback. But if I don't ask the question, people very politely do not usually make an observation.
So you are the lone parent of a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So still around girls. You have a girl. I mean, she's a big girl, not
she's
a tiny
19,
girl.
Yeah.
You touched on it before about her skin. How have you managed, and have you had to manage your feedback to her about her appearance? Because I know this is so influential, the way mothers and daughters talk about appearances. What have you learned along the way about that? It's a tricky issue, body image and self-esteem.
Yeah, there's a few things. So I'm going to say both of them. One is that Lila doesn't exercise hardly and she eats tons of sweets. So I know at some stage it might bug her that at 19, she probably has a bit of cellulite because of that, because she's like sitting there, she's stagnant, all right? So I kind of might occasionally say, you know, your girl, you know, she has girlfriends who go to a gym or whatever. Lila didn't do sport for 9 years at school, all right? She was literally professionally on the off games list. So
she's me.
Yeah, all right. She's me. I mean, I hate sport. But I sort of think it's important to get that body moving and to get the toxins and fluids moving. So I just feel it is. I'm not quite a French woman, which is here's the micellar water and here's the vinegar and drink that.
And don't eat. Yeah.
And Lila has a very good body image. And so I wouldn't. But that's how I feel around that, because I have the thing of when I was 19 and think, oh, you know, it's a bit of cellulite, whatever. So there's that. Then there's the fact that people always say she's so gorgeous. And when she was younger, I didn't want her to hear it because I don't want her ever
Tell me about that.
Know. So I think I wouldn't ever want her to feel I'm gorgeous in a way that's not attractive. Where Lila has I'm gorgeous is God knows how, but she has a self-belief in 90% of what I never had at her age.
Like what?
Like, so I'll say to her now, like if anyone else said to her, you look lovely, she'd say, oh, thank you, and look a little bit like that. But if I say, you look gorgeous, she said, I know I'm gorgeous. I know I am.
Love
like that.
That,
because she has this confidence around me of, I know I am. And she's incredibly polite with people. She's much politer than me in situations of stress around transportation at airports and things. Really polite, doesn't get stressed in it. And I'll just think, thank God. Thank God she's not me in this instance. Because I am at my worst in a kind of airport moment. That's my worst moments ever of behaviour.
Are you a stressy person?
No, I'm because I get quite a lot done, but I've lived in many airports, you know, and I took 60 flights a year for, you know, 5 years when I was travelling. So when things don't go in the flow, I have a flow. Like I go through Terminal 5 in this flow. I literally know the baggage handlers and the people at passport control. So when the flow isn't working, I'm like out of kilter. Or when somebody says they take my Trinilon stacks, which I know are solid and shouldn't be taken, and they go, but it's makeup. And I go, but it's solid. It's makeup, it's solid. You know, we have this kind of back and forth. But she's calm. She's very good that way. So she has the best of her dad. So she has amazing sense of humour. Because I always thought I didn't really have a sense of humour. Especially with Susanna, who I also had a phenomenal sense of humour, self-deprecating and sense of humour. And I was a bit more earnest on what not to wear. And I think that thing of us going our separate ways in our career, I had to find my humour. And then I realised people found me funny, either because I just do crazy things and I don't have a, you know, I don't zip it.
You've got no filter.
I have zero filter. And so I'm happy that people find it amusing. But Lila has a clever sense of humour. You know, she's very good on a little thing. And that I don't have that. She has that.
You mentioned stress, albeit airport-based. But you've talked and written extensively about mental health issues and so on. You mentioned at the top exercise. How important has looking after your body been to the health of your mind?
Paramount. I had a time when I was doing those few years abroad. And so when I was in England, I would do 10 Pilates. It was this Pilates thing every single day because I knew when I was traveling, I wouldn't do it at all. So I'd like catch up obsessively, but it was always Pilates. I started Pilates in 82 with a very nice guy who had learnt with Ernesto Pilates or whatever he's called in New York. And he was about 70 when he taught me, and he died of AIDS in the early 80s. And it's a thing that consistently for me, because I'm very, I'm tall and I have quite a bad back. It's just the best thing to align and give me a good core. So it's always been there. And I've had a few, hardly anything wrong with me health-wise, but I had a replacement in my neck of my C3 and C4. So I've had times when I couldn't do anything. Since that moment, and because my mother never exercised, and my mother became quite debilitated when she was older and she had Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. So I am obsessive of what I do every week so that my body will look after me. It's like my one motivation. So I do, you know, in during lockdown, I started doing exercise and I just share them on my channel. I still do it. We still have 400 women, or between 200 and 400 women on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday with Natalie or with Victoria Woodall on Tuesday and Saturday.
Love Victoria.
And we do it together. And if those women weren't waiting for me to click on at 7:30, I would not do it either. They motivate me to have to do it. So it's whatever it takes. But I see it as the medicine I need to make sure that my body is being looked after. And it's not a vanity matrix. It's not, let me get good abs or toned legs. It's literally, I want to be 90. I want to be even more than Iris Lovely Apfel, who's 102. And I look at her and, you know, she wears such heavy jewellery. I don't know how she stands up. But I just feel...
She's so slim as well. She's carrying a lot of metal.
Yeah. And incredibly, these legs like a sort of gazelle. So I just look at that and I think, I was saying this last night at this thing, I wanted to be, you know, I quite love David Sinclair and I listen to him a lot, who's this longevity expert. He's a professor at Harvard and he has this longevity lab and he's always talking on podcasts about it. And he talks about metformin and he talks about, you know, not the thing that people take once a week for a thing, but metformin is actually, if you are a diabetic and it's about reducing your insulin levels and the longevity around metformin and that we, you know, there's people living today who will live to 120. So I'm thinking I'm one of them. So I said last night, it's like, if you think you've got 20 summers left, your body starts to behave in a way. But if you say, hey, I'm halfway through my life, so I'm going to be 60 in a few months, halfway through my life. So what does that mean in terms of where I'm at and what it does mean is I'll have to be older, earning money still. That's the only thing last night when I was giving this thing of like, okay, if I'm 90...
What am I going to eat?
What am I going to eat? So it does mean that you've got to financially plan well, because if you've got, you know, a lot of people think, well, I've got money for my retirement and, you know, they have this sort of finite
assuming
sense.
They die at 80 or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're going to keep going. And you want to have a quality of life. I don't want to have a bad quality of life. But I do feel if I say by 80, life might be over, I think subconsciously we prep ourselves for that time and I don't want to be that person, you know.
And what about longevity of appearance? I think you're so refreshing around beauty treatments, injectables and so on, in that you just don't seem to think it's much of a big deal, neither do I.
No.
Tell me about your relationship with that. How did you first decide you were going to do a little something something?
The first thing was a vanity not over appearance. And it was when Dr. Sebag had just come to London. He was this incredibly rude Frenchman.
Yeah.
He didn't speak English. He had a place not at Wimpole Street, there somewhere else. And somebody said, because I was just starting doing a telly pilot, and I was looking at the rushes, and my forehead moved so much. I thought, this is weird. And somebody said, you know, you can get your forehead frozen. I was like, amazing. It wasn't, because I didn't have lines then. It was like, that would be the nirvana. So I went to see him, and I remember the first time I saw him, and somebody had to translate, literally. There's a woman there translating. And he was so blasé, and I was like, didn't know what it was, didn't really explain to me, and I thought, I'll just do it and see. And it was a miracle. I did telly the next week, and my forehead did move. It was brilliant. And he said, come back every 6 months, which I've done for 27 years. I did it when I was 35, 45, 55, 29 years. So that was my beginning of my relationship with Sebag. And when I find people I like, I don't like to move either. And then I still had my, I'd had my acne, but I had scarring, very bad scarring.
Very
and I had
common.
Those kind of like, you know, those deep ice pick, you know, sort of 0.5 millimeter kind of scars. And they separate when you got older. And he said, you can do a CO2 laser. And I remember this is the funniest thing that happened. There were a few kind of interesting people who went to his surgery, and he put me under for it. So he put me under, did a strong CO2. I remember waking up, looking down at me was Princess Michael of Kent.
No.
And he was saying, look and see, this is, look how Trini looks. So I was like,
Oh my word.
I just remember it was because it was such a madhouse then of all these people coming in and out of it and all these, you know, it was just, I remember this moment so well. And I got a diary. I think a very important thing whenever you're thinking of doing some treatment is you should get somebody who's done a diary of something, because it's like when you spend money and don't want to admit what you've spent. The same when you're obsessed about this treatment will sort out this.
That's really true.
You just get rid of what might be the downside. So, you know, this woman had said day one, it was fine. Day two, I turned like a tomato. So I knew it would get worse before it got better. So I stayed at home. I put that Elizabeth Arden triple wear on day sort of 12, and Susanna was coming round to walk the dog, and I was like, oh, I look fine. But I opened the door and she went, oh my God, you think you can go outside? But I'd had 12 days inside thinking I was fine.
Yeah.
But my pigmentation, by the way, it affects pigmentation, whatever anyone says. And I wasn't so specific then about SPF 50 every day. So I did get a bit of hyperpigmentation from it. But it did soften my very bad scarring. And so that, I think, for people who are prepared to go down an ablative route, it is, you know, and if you have acne scarring and pitting, it's, you know, it's, it reminds you so much of your spots. So I understand to do it. So those are my biggest things that are that. And then I've done, you know, the under eye trough. And when I did it with Sebag again, he did it with something that was, I had very bad indents, and he never went back because he said, oh, you know, it's just so delicate. It's so difficult to do, and it can so screw up, and you can so get it caught in a tear duct, not tear duct, but the duct under your eye, and then you can have that puffy eye. So you've got to be really careful about these things. So I like those kind of treatments. I go to Teresa Tommy, and I have fractional radio frequency, which I think is a brilliant way. I think Fraxel is, I'm in two minds about Fraxel. But fractional radio frequency, I love, because I love microneedling. So the combination of that therapy with the microneedling, to me, it's good. That stimulation of the skin, gentle damaging of the skin, repair of the skin. I love that cycle. And then great skincare when you're doing it.
Yeah. You know? What I say to people all of the time is that skincare and injectables do two completely different things. They're not remotely interchangeable. Mm. You know, when I see people on the internet say, you know, someone says, oh, your skin looks gorgeous. And someone else goes, ah, it's all the Botox. They have nothing to do with one another.
Yeah.
I mean,
and I think
one has no material effect on the quality of the skin.
A good example, I mean, I wouldn't say the person's name, but I have a friend who's a bit in the public eye, and they don't have much of a skincare routine, but they do Botox and different things. But when I look at the texture of their skin, it's not great.
Right.
You know, it's just, it doesn't have that kind of, when I go up to you, Sally, I see skin going, hello. And they have skin that's going, oh, I'm a bit tired. You know, and it might be the filler is there and the Botox is there, but that daily maintenance, that daily gentle exfoliation, feeding it with interesting ingredients. And also not just cleansing and moisturising, because life is not that anymore, and it shouldn't be, because the way that we can get ingredients deeper into the skin is very different. You know, it's not just marketing has become better. There are some incredible small molecule sizes, things can penetrate deeply, you get the right formulations, you can really make a change. So
it's true. I say this to people all the time, that there is no bad product anymore. Mm. There isn't. It's kind of impossible to find bad product. You know, a £2 lip gloss.
Retinol palmitate? Sorry. I'd say it's a bad product, and I wouldn't buy a retinol with that in it.
A £2 lipstick now is better than a £20 lipstick 20
colour?
Years ago.
Yeah, for sure.
And things are better all the time. So it's really about how you're using it, the frequency mm-hmm. with which you're using it, how you're combining things together. Mm. You do look absolutely extraordinary. How do you feel now when you look in the mirror?
It's truthfully all about how I feel, tired or not. Hair is a big thing for me.
Tell me.
So I have Greg, who has blow-dried my hair for years. And if I don't have a Greg blow-dry, I then am in the hugest panic. It's like my drug addict has stopped providing. You know, it's that sort of like you have relationships with different people in your life. So I travel a lot for work, and I'm going in 10 days to America and to Australia. So the biggest thing for my team, because we're doing a lot of personal appearances and TV and everything, is finding a hairdresser who will copy the Greg thing. So I thought, okay, so then Greg and I did a detailed video. All right, which I then sent to you. I said, edit it, just like the tips and tricks, because otherwise what they do is they'll use tongs. And I hate tongs.
So
and
what
I
do
hate
you want?
Straighteners. I
you
just
want
think
rollers?
They kill hair.
Or you no. want a brush and a dryer.
He uses a bristle brush.
Yeah.
And he doesn't burn the hair. And he doesn't, you know, he's just, my hair is in good nick because Greg doesn't kill my hair every time he blow dries. And there's so many places you get a blow dry and they want you in and out in 20 minutes and they're going to use the worst heat on you. They're not going to protect
right.
your hair. So I'm very paranoid about hair. And I lost a third of my hair during COVID. So, you know, getting it back was a big deal. So that much more will affect how I see myself than anything else. Because I look after my skin. I do, you know, every morning I spend 15 minutes and I really am, you know, I have a routine I never veer from. So,
which is what?
Which is complicated.
as complicated as you like. So, we like a high maintenance girl.
So I cleanse my skin with balm cleanser. And then I generally will put on a current body thing that mm-hmm. will take a current, and mm-hmm. I'll do New Face or mm-hmm. I'll do Face Gym Pro. I'll just do that kind of like micro current. So some days I'll do that. Mm-hmm. And then other days I will start with a PHA, a spritz of water, a peptide with some hyaluronic, and then a vitamin C, and then an SPF 50. And that's my day. But I'll use a Bayan Gua Sha. I don't like the jade ones because they always break, but the Bayan one I really like, and it's a very good thing. I always go around my lymph nodes around and behind front of my ear.
I'm puffy when I wake up. Are you?
I always do those little circles at the back and front. I always go around down the clavicle. So I do that releasing every morning. And so it just sets me up for the day. And then by the time I'm then putting my makeup on stuff, I just feel I'm looking how I want to look. And I always brush up my eyebrows. Like even before I do a Instagram exercise, I'll do that skincare and I'll brush up my brows.
It's an instant facelift, the brushing up of the brows, isn't it? It goes an awfully long way to make your brows more vertical.
Yeah.
I know you're not going to say you're gorgeous because I know it will horrify you. But when you look in the mirror, do you think, do you know what? Pretty good.
I do it when John has done my makeup, special occasion or something, when somebody else has made me look great, because I am quite a critique of myself. You know, I'd be like, oh, you really didn't put the eye makeup on that well, Trini, because I'm in a, you know, when I'm doing, or doing back of the car or whatever. And when John does my makeup, he's methodical, and then I'll feel great. And I'll, you know, it will make me feel great. And he's also, sometimes I will go from being at work, rushing home, and then going out. So I don't have the chance to kind of reset. But if I'm doing something with him, it's generally I've come home, I'm going to change. I'm probably putting on something like glamorous. He's doing my makeup. And he's in a brilliant mood. He's an Irishman and works with us at Trinity London. But he has such a good spirit that whatever tension might have been on my face, he releases with his personality, which makes me feel I look nice.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I think tension and stress are the things more than anything else that make us look in the mirror and think we're tired.
Yeah.
And when we feel we're tired, we feel a little down in life. And those are the things that when I look in the mirror and I feel tired and down in life, that's what will affect me the most.
And do you like you? Do you like the person inside when you look at yourself?
Yeah, because the person inside is the person outside, which it wasn't for so many years. It, you know, probably got to that place fully formed at 50.
At 50?
Yeah. Yeah.
So 50 was a big one.
Yes. A lot happened.
Emotionally?
Yeah. A lot happened. Yeah.
In terms of business, for sure.
Mm.
So now you have a book out. It's Riding High. Why did you decide to write it and what did you think needed saying?
It's all the information, and you'll probably get this, of what day did you say that, Sally, and mm-hmm. where was it, and that mm-hmm. information. And it was just bringing everything together. And then I had to think, what do I talk about a lot that people ask a lot about? So the obvious ones are beauty and style, but also on my sort of Saturday morning chats and Sunday morning chats, which is life and starting a business, or, you know, should you drink alcohol? Should you take drugs? Sex? How we feel hormonally? And just snippets of that. So the life bit is the bit actually I most enjoyed writing, because I wanted to give women inspiration who might feel they've got to a little flat pace in their life and they want something else to galvanize them. And the most comments I've got from the book is, it made me think about this in my life, which is great, because that's, you know, the other bit, the other bit's there to be the sweetie shop for you to kind of buy it and then think, oh, maybe I could. And at the end of each chapter, I say, ask yourself and challenge yourself, because I think books should be interactive, you know, so how could I make the book interactive?
And which were the bits where you stumbled on life and thought, need to examine this more closely, need to put some things into action?
I think that I write a tiny bit about our whole relationship around manifestation, mm-hmm. which I think is a bit like, let me cringe with embarrassment. Mm. You know, because you see all these people on social, manifest.
Yes, but there is something. This is a particular trigger point for me. Right, I can't bear it. It drives me up the wall.
Yeah. One or two people.
Yeah.
And, but I do believe that if we live in the belief that something is going to be good, there is a great chance it will be good. And if we live in the belief of all the things that are going to go wrong, there's a great chance it might not happen. So how do you then do a little something? And so for me, writing it forced me to challenge more, what do I do? So during COVID, I put on a, you know, that we've got a wall on the right here, but I put on these post-it notes all the things about the business and the revenue I wanted to hit and the number of customers and the other things I wanted to do. And it was visually and it was out, and every day I was looking at it and it made me focused. And when COVID ended, I stopped that. I was very famous in my office for post-it notes. I post-it note everything when we were brainstorming, building the site. You know, I'm the post-it note queen. So last week, I was rereading that bit and I thought, it's time to take my own advice again here, because I know this so well. So I just put these post-it notes on my thing of, you know, how many, where I'd like the book to be in by Christmas, where I'd like Lila to be emotionally by the next year. When am I going to buy this house that I don't own yet? And what does it look like? So I went around to the street and took a picture of the house and I put it on the wall. And the most important thing for me in this whole thing of that visioning your future is you've got to understand the journey as a challenge. And if you don't vision how challenging that journey will be, you're trying to get the free pass, you know, and it is a journey to get anything in life that you think will bring richness to your life.
There are a few things more challenging, having written a few myself, than writing a book.
Mm.
It's a big job and it's just you. You know, when people say to me at events, you know, I really want to write a book, how do I do it? I know people just want an answer that isn't, you just have to write the book.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, is the only way to write a book. You have to sit down, you have to write it.
Well, you don't have to write it, because I'm very bad. I'm better at speaking.
Oh, I do have to write it.
Okay. So I speak.
Okay.
Yes, I speak and transcribe more than I physically write.
Okay.
Because I can't read my own writing and I'm very dyslexic.
You still have quite a long process to get through.
Very long.
And especially when you write in the first person, as I do, as you do, you have to confront a lot of things mm-hmm. about yourself, because mm-hmm. it is literally your own voice, mm-hmm. your writing, or in your case, speaking in your own voice. Which bits were really daunting for you?
Things where I thought, how personal do I get to get the message across?
Same.
Because there's got to be a line between our private life and our public life. And that's challenging for me because I will have instances where I'll chat very intimately on Instagram and Facebook because I just feel we're in this intimate private room, which we're sort of not, but I kind of feel we are. And then I will do an interview with a journalist and sometimes chat in that way and things will be taken in, you know, some grabby way and maybe misinterpreted. So that's a challenge for me to get the balance on that.
I really get that. So all of my challenges like that are around, well, I have to give something of myself to justify why I'm even talking about this. And it's a generosity to the reader because you're asking them to read with an open heart. And so you have to be open, but also I'm a really private person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's kind of balancing those things is really, really tricky, isn't it?
I think there's, in my private life, you know, I might share about my worry for Lila, but that's something that I'll share knowing other people have that too. So we can all talk about it. In terms of my relationship, I would, you know, I've never talked about my relationship. And then I ended my relationship. I put one comment on Instagram that I'm in the mountains, you know, doing. And there was, you know, lots of pages of press the next day. So it's very, there's also what's interesting is you have an intimacy with an audience where you don't want to be lying to them in by omission. You
right.
know? And it's that trust. So,
right.
So it's important to, you know, when I'm suddenly in a new house, then why are you in this house, Trini? You were in another house for 10 years. You're suddenly in a different house, you know. But I don't want to share. So it's just, you know, starting a new chapter. But that's it.
I totally get that. Well, fortunately, the only relationship I'm interested in is the one you have with yourself. And you've been so, so, so generous in sharing that with me. Thank you so much for coming on. You're so inspiring. I have so much respect for you. I'm really grateful that you came and had a chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you so much for listening. Please do take the time to subscribe and leave a review if you enjoyed today's episode. And I will see you next time with another brilliant woman. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Insanity Group.